When you speak about calm water, or you speak about a lot of water, you have a very, very hard problem in defining it. You can't. When somebody says it's a big building, well, what does a big building mean? A big building can mean, some people think this building is big, some people think it's small. It depends who you ask, depends what you compare it to. So anytime you have an adjective, you really, really are kind of stuck with asking yourself, what is it? So for instance, one might try to define orthodoxy, we'll see in a second. It's a little easier because keeping all the laws as they're written in Shulchan Aruch, and as believing that it was given, that the laws were given at Sinai, that there's a God, he gave us laws at Sinai, we're obligated morally to keep it, and the laws are as they appear in Shulchan Aruch, that's at least a fairly good definition. Just like, let's take some parallel, Christianity would be defined somebody who believes in Yeshu, that's a definition. Modern, well, some people would consider me very modern, some consider me very old-fashioned. And the truth is, it depends what you're comparing it to. So really, you're grappling with something that is more a sort of a sense of something, something that is socially, generally seen as something, but very, very hard to give it a frozen definition. And that's why when people speak about modern orthodoxy with a capital M and a capital O, we're going to have a problem, because it's really an adjective and not a noun, and certainly not an organization. So we'll try to wrestle a little bit with some of the sense of it, but it's very hard because no one is the posek of modern orthodoxy. No one could even define modern orthodoxy. So let's try, but there is something like that, and we can get a sense of it. First of all, the word orthodoxy is a relatively new invention, the word orthodoxy. The word orthodoxy actually was incorporated in Judaism after the word reform was incorporated. The reform movement started first in the, you can trace it at the end of the 1700s, early 1800s, and the lashback, the sort of the people who were not reforming Judaism were called Orthodox, borrowed from the Christian sense, Orthodox versus Catholic, meaning somebody who is the true thinker, true shita, that type of thing. So orthodoxy itself really is a modern term. That's the truth. Now, as orthodoxy described a huge range of people who felt the Torah obligates them, no matter what, people began to classify and notice that there are different types of people. So you have Hasidish, you have just Haredi, which is kind of a general term, modern, more modern, less modern. So let's try to identify, what are the areas in which one looks to describe modern? Who are the people that might be singled out as being fathers of the movement of sorts, or at least people that we can put in that same framework? And we'll talk a little bit about some of it. So, first of all, one would say the level of interaction with the world around, both in terms of perspective. Do we look at the Torah as focused on Jewish people and that's it? Or do we look at the world as a whole and Judaism as a message for all of humanity, except we're the only ones that hear the message and embody the message, or hope to embody it, is a better word of saying it. That's one area where there are differences, and that will give you... So modern would be, in a sense, universal versus parochial. Two, how much do we identify, how much of worldly mores, in other words, the dress of people, the mannerisms of people, the culture of people, the sort of normal human sort of activities and behavior. How much do we stand aside? How much do we become part of it? Finally, in terms of the hard sciences, how important and significant is it? And Lastly, perhaps, the what we call philosophy, in the big sense, with a big P, you know, any liberal art type of pursuit, how much of that would we incorporate, allow, and perhaps even find laudable? Those are the areas with which people have used to sort of grade different shades of modern, less modern, more modern. And again, it's always going to be shades of more and less. So who are the people that are considered the sort of, I don't say the prototype, and one of them is going to be a real anachronism, but the Rambam is first. The Rambam being a person who was, there was no bigger Talmud Chacham, somebody who was extremely, extremely conversant with philosophy and science of his day. He tackled ideas, sometimes rejected them vehemently, sometimes incorporated them. Somebody who also interacted in terms of being a doctor. Had a very small part of his life, but he was a doctor and a very important doctor, and we'll see a description of his. And final, so that's one. Two, going very, very forward, one would say Reb Shlomo Shaphal Hirsch, born in 1808, died in 1888. He actually came to the world as a fanatic. In other words, German Jewry saw him as a reactionary. They saw him as a right-wing fanatic because he came in as somebody that was taking community that was gone and pushing them back. And he was able to do it because the beautiful German he spoke, the ideas that he proposed, the way he gave over Torah, many, many things, and incorporated certain things in his understanding. We have Rav Kook, who in many ways was very old-fashioned. He wore shtreimel, he wore long garments. We would consider him probably a bit of a Chassidish Rebbe in terms of his interactions and so on. On the other hand, he had a very universal look at things and welcomed certain areas of worldly, of the knowledge and culture of the world, which he felt had value, great value, and so on. Finally, Rav Soloveitchik, who was also a Talmud Chacham of impeccable credentials and was educated, spoke, he was extremely conversant with everything that, you know, philosophy, very, very, and presented his ideas in a way that were magnificent and was able to project an image that incorporated a lot bigger picture than just a Yiddish devil. Those are probably the four figures that are most, that have the credentials of being both very big Talmud Chachamim and definitely had some of those elements we spoke about. I want to focus on two of the four. The Rambam and Reb Shlomo Shaphal Hirsch. And I want to raise the following question that is going to be the point around which I'm bringing the material together. What distinguishes a modern Orthodox person from somebody who's just not keeping so many mitzvahs, from somebody who is just who just by default floats along with the world around him? After all, Avraham Avinu is called Ivri, the Medrash says, because the entire world was on one side of the river, he was the other. He was the lone man. He was the fanatic. He was the crackpot who didn't believe in what all scientists and philosophers believed in. We look at Avodah Zarah as being primitive, old-fashioned, etc., etc. Avodah Zarah was it. That was society from A to Z was Avodah Zarah. He was the nut that said, you're all wrong, you're all crazy, and stood by it. So Avraham Avinu, so how do we distinguish the two, one from the other? So I'd like to look at the Rambam himself and get a feel for, I don't want to say conflicting, but the two sides of a person who is willing to go out and incorporate things, see things, and yet not someone who swept along, but makes a decision about what and when. Let's first look, I'm going to read from two places in the Rambam. Now, of the Rambam's Svarim, the Mishnah Torah usually should take first
place. Mishnah Torah is the one written in Hebrew. That's why it's very important. The Mishnah Torah he wrote when he had all the freedom in the world. He was sitting and learning. He had nothing else on his mind. His brother supported him. And was able to sit for 10 years and make the Mishnah Torah. Mishnah Torah is his sense of the entire Torah put together. So Mishnah Torah usually should get primacy when discussing things. And then after that, I would choose his igros, his letters. There are letters of his around. Somebody, Professor Shalat, Yitzhak Shalat, a modern Orthodox professor, put them out. Wonderful job. I mean, they were put out before, but he really did a wonderful job on it. And he sifts through the letters that are authentic, the letters that might be authentic, and the letters that are certainly not authentic. And he does an amazing job. And it's worth it. They're very, very important. And then after that, the Mor Nevuchim and so on. But I want to look at one or two, three points, and we'll get a sense of how complex it is. The first place is in the Rambam's second chapter, Mishneh Torah. The Rambam speaks about how does one come to love God and to fear God. I'm going to read very little. V'heichi aderech lavas yaseh. What is the way to love and fear God? So now I'm going to just translate. When a person looks around the world and he sees God's creation, incredible creation, and he sees a wisdom without end and nothing comparable, he's automatically drawn to it, inspired by it, praises it, and has a tremendous craving to get to know God. As King David said, "My soul thirsts for you, O living God." And as a person is engaged in this thought, he's thrown back and he becomes scared and he says, "I am this tiny infinitesimal little being with a very, very shallow and small mind, standing in front of the ultimate in wisdom." Like, and then he quotes David HaMelech again. And the Rambam says, "And therefore I'm going to be spending two chapters over here describing the entire world and everything about it, so that you get the same sense of awe that I have gotten." So the Rambam says, understanding and knowing the world around, the physical world we're talking about, and getting a deeper sense in its magnificence, its complexity, its order, its structure, brings you to love God and to fear God. He says something very similar in a letter of his. And the letters are remarkable because the letters are dictated by whatever people asked him. It's not a point that he's trying to make. Someone asked him the following question. If anybody has the Shalat, if anyone wants to look it up, it is the 32nd question. It says in the Gemara that if somebody knows, has what it takes to know astronomy, and he doesn't engage in it, it's not good. Why? Why is it so important? That's what the question asked him. So he said when they speak about Kufis and Mazalas, it means astronomy in general. And they said, what does it mean if he knows? A person who has a brain and knows enough math and whatever else is needed to know astronomy, and he doesn't he doesn't engage in it, the person is doing something that's not quite right. You ask me, what's the point of it? So he says, well, Reb Meir says in a Braisa, look at God's creations, because if you look into it, you're going to come to know the person that said and created the world. And therefore, in the beginning of my great work, the Mishnah Torah, I explained it, I went through it all. So the Rambam here has an extremely positive, not only extremely positive, but one would say quite mandatory to look around and to see the world of God, God's creations, and to admire its complexity, its depth, and to be moved and inspired by it. That's one Rambam. Then the Rambam says, let me read another Rambam, which talks about mores, culture, and so on. So this is in Hilchos Avodah Zarah, 11th, the chapter 11, the first halacha. A person cannot engage in chukos hagoyim, What is chukas hagoyim? Not the dress they wear, not the hairstyle they wear. And he brings the psukim, three or four psukim. And it's the same thing. It's all these psukim have one point, not to be similar culturally. The Jew, Aliyah Yisraeli Muvdalman, the Jew needs to be different, distinct. And he needs to be recognized by his dress and by his conduct, just like he is distinguished from them in his understanding. And the Pasuk says, I will separate you from the nations around. So we have a very, very, very different approach. The Rambam says when it comes to the general cultural mores, we need to be distinct. We need to be able to look at somebody and say, he's Jewish. And the Rambam, it adds to it. The Rambam says, because if your thinking and understanding is different, then you should reflect it in your mannerisms. I want to flesh that out a bit. If I wanted to introduce you somebody who is, I would say, this person, I tell somebody, no, I have a lot of money to invest. I have a few million dollars I'd like to invest. Could you introduce me to somebody, a serious investment person? Then I would, and then introduce me to somebody who's dressed like a lifeguard. You know, it's not that a lifeguard may not know how to invest money, but it would take me a lot of convincing that this guy knows what he's doing. On the other hand, if I came to the beach and the person sitting on the chair looked like he's a banker in a three-piece suit, I would hesitate to swim in the beach, unless I knew how to swim, because he doesn't strike me as being a very lifeguard type. So yes, there are bankers who know how to swim, but there's something about a person's chitzonios. There's a reason why a person dresses a certain way. Color, style, formal, less formal, provocative, all of those are statements. And they should reflect who you are. If a Jewish person has a more serious outlook on life, then his clothing and his mannerisms and his bearing, everything about him should reflect it. And then the Rambam goes through certain halachas. He incorporates some real halachas into this, such as the issur of cutting the pays and so on. Now, this is notoriously difficult to quantify halachically. You know, what do we consider the general dress? And it's not something where you can give very clear-cut halachic points about it. But at least in terms of perspective, the Rambam here seems to be extremely coming from a very different place. Whereas the Rambam is in awe and feels it's a very religious obligation to look at the world in the big picture, at God's world. But on the other hand, in terms of culture, expression, and so on, Rambam seems to be very different. I want to read a letter, another letter of the Rambam. This is a letter written to a Rabbi Yosef. Rabbi Yosef seemed to have been an extremely close disciple, Talmud Rambam. The Rambam wrote the Guide for Perplexed as a gift to this Rabbi Yosef. Rabbi Yosef had come, studied with the Rambam. The Rambam wrote the most beautiful letter about how how he's come to admire the student's depth and beauty of soul and so on. I don't know who it is, no one knows who it is, but this person must have been a huge person if the Rambam finds him to be, he was a disciple of the Rambam, he was a Talmud, he was much younger. But the Rambam writes extremely, he always calls him my son, and he writes very, very admiringly of him. First of all, he writes about some personal tragedy, this Talmud, and the Rambam comforts him about a young child that had died. And then he says, Beis, this is, if somebody's going to want to look it up, it's K'taim Me'igeret El Rabbi Yosef B'inyan Mikrei HaChayim. It's Reish Amud Reish Samach Beis. If anybody wants to look it up inside. So we don't. The problem with the letters is we usually have the answer. We don't have the questions like those contests. Well, I'll give you the answer. Tell me the question. So it seems as if the Rambam had just been appointed the doctor to whoever the king, and he wrote him. Wow, this is amazing. So he says like this. He answers him back. My dear son knows that these important position of Jews at this time is not considered by me success, and I don't think in any way this is a type of success one should aim for. It actually is quite bad God forbid. It is difficult, drudgery, and very, very difficult. Now, I think what he's hinting at is that if a Jewish person is in a very high position in the government, then usually, if he's successful, they won't give him much credit. And if he's not successful, it's the Jew that killed the Sultan. So you don't get much, you don't get far. I think he's sort of hinting that. But then he says, the real success of a person is religious success, doing what you're supposed to do and not following the herd. And to stay away from bad and from what's reprehensible and so on. Besides which, as I become more important, you're always running the risk of people getting jealous, telling bad things about you to the king, which actually happened, and eventually they'll break his bones for it. So he said, and if you try to play politics, be nice to people, then you're engaging in chanufa, masupanim, in flattery, which the Torah says is bad. The Torah says you're not allowed to compliment people that are sinners, and therefore I'm stuck in a dilemma, and it's nothing to compliment me about. So the Rambam here does not seem to feel that his position is in any way good or important, certainly not the success. The medical knowledge, yes, but the fact that everybody says, wow, look at this, look what a Jew can become in Mitzrayim, the Rambam does not feel that that was very, very successful. One more area where I think it's important that the Rambam, understanding the Rambam, how the Rambam sort of split two different types of knowledge. The Rambam, this is the Rambam Guide for Perplexed. It's in the second part. The Guide for Perplexed has three parts to it, and it's Perichav Beis. He says, I will tell you a general rule, and even though some people don't like this, meaning people that are more quote-unquote from than him, but I still want to tell you what I believe is true. Anything that Aristotle speaks about the natural world, now he uses a different phrase. His phrase is that which is under the galgal yireach. We'll translate it for our terms, anything which is in our natural world, trust Aristotle. Much of Aristotle was written was science, and he felt, and it's true 100%, stick by it, because the only people that don't hold of it are people that are either prejudiced or they have an issue with him. But anything that Aristotle speaks beyond that, all it is a hypothesis, a fantasy of his, and it's something which very little to be gained by it, and so on. No proof, and so on. In other words, the Rambam cuts a very sharp line between science, provable, testable, to ideas, philosophies, and so on. It's not that the Rambam doesn't use Aristotle's ideas when he feels it's the right description, but he has zero in terms of an a priori trust to what he said. It's not right because Aristotle said it. It's right because I find out that in the Torah, Aristotle has the best formulation for it. So here we understand the Rambam has a nuanced approach. Again, accepting science because it's testable, provable, and anything that's hypothesis, ideas, philosophies, and so on, much, much more cautious and not willing to give him that type of credence.
Sorry, yeah. I have to get them out.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Good Hanukkah, fellow Hanukkah boys, girls. Okay. Now we can get to the adult stuff. I got rid of the kids. Now, okay. So the Rambam is actually very, very nuanced in his approach. And the one thing that, and we'll see in Rosh Hashanah also, maybe I'll try to finish round four and then we'll have some time for questions and stuff. Rosh Hashanah, like we said before, his upbringing was a combination of, he went to university a bit, he never had a degree, never graduated. He studied in Hungary with and in Germany. He studied by the Arif Lener and so on. Everybody tries to make him out to be what he is. He's everything from Haredi to super modern Orthodox, depending on who's writing the book. But in an honest way, let's try to just point out some things. He's unlike other rabbanim of his generation. He spoke a beautiful German, a beautiful, sophisticated German that was extremely pleasant to listen to. He was a masterful orator, and it was no shame to sit and listen to him. Two, his understanding of what Torah is and what it's for was universal. I mean, on and on and on in his svarim, he speaks about how Torah is a way to make the entire world a good world, and we Jewish people are sort of the spearhead. We're sort of the advanced God to make it happen. But he spoke an awful lot about it. Three, he admired certain thinkers that he felt were extremely were brought out ideas magnificently. There was a German poet, one of the great ones, Schiller, that he said if he would have met him, he would have made a bracha on him because he felt that he had so much wisdom. So those are areas that one could identify him as modern. However, let me read something. This is from somebody named Gretz. I hope you've heard of him. He was the first Jewish historian. Let's say religiously, he'd probably be identified as a conservative Jew today. Traditional in sort of not religious but traditional, engaged in Jewish studies, but didn't believe really in Torah Sinai, and he is actually considered to be in many ways part of that general culture. Him, Chaim Frankel, others. That was sort of the what would be the predecessors of conservative Judaism today. He wrote a letter to Rav Hirsch. Rav Hirsch had put out a book, The 19 Letters, that really was the first Kirov outreach book, and people were very taken by it. He was the first person that could present Yiddishkeit in a language that fit his generation. And he wrote a letter, I'm a troubled yeshiva bach, I'd like to study with you. He spent 3 years studying with Rav Shamshon Fall Hirsch. He left, and then he sort of changed and became non-frum, traditional, whatever it is. But he has a diary, Gretz. And it was printed in German. I can read a very halting German, but I saw the English translation. I just couldn't find the English translation print. I could only find the German. So I'm not going to read it. I mean, I can read it, but it's not going to help me or you. So I just have it so that you know that it's there. What are the things he studied with Hirsch? Well, they'd wake up 4 in the morning. So if you want to read modern Orthodox, I'd wake up 4 in the morning to study. You learn Gemara and Orachayim. 6 to 8 is Betten and Frühstück, which means davening and breakfast. 8 to 10 is Gemara. 10 to 12, Greek. 1 to 3, Geschichte or the Latin or the Physik, which means either history or Latin or physics. 3 to 5, mathematics and geography. 6 to 8, Tanakh and a Poisik. That was a schedule. It says in places he sat and they would read. Sometimes they switched around. They would do a cant together and so on. On the other hand, on the same page, he brings a story. He said they were reading something, a philosopher. He says the name also. This actually doesn't mean anything to me. Heinz Salon was der Fuller Blasphemie und Minusis. He said, Rashan Fall Hirsch, they were reading it, and he said, this is full of kefir and apikarsis. Let's burn the book and I'll pay for it at the library. No, he said, I'm going to burn the book. So Gratz told him what belongs to the library. He says, we'll pay the library, we'll burn the book. It's also to keep a book like that. Finally, prevailed on him not to burn the book, so he just sliced out the page that was Kfira and sent it back. That does not sound very modern Orthodox. He was very strong about it. There was his wealthiest balabas who supported him. His name was Rothschild. Okay, so it doesn't come for a surprise. Rothschild was a family of wealthy people, and the Meir Anshel was the first one, and then I think he didn't have children. But the one that was in Frankfurt was Willy Karl, I think, Rothschild, and he was a big supporter. He built his buildings and so on and so forth. His daughter fell in love with somebody not religious, not observant at all. And he came and he asked Hashem Shmuel Hirsch if he should consent to her marrying this boy. And he said, no. So he said, well, she's threatened to commit suicide if I don't let her get married to him. And he thought a moment and he said, even so. Rothschild never spoke to him again. He was furious, never spoke to him again. He actually did build a building for him, but he never spoke to him. This daughter married this boy. All their children are goyim. In other words, literally goyim. They just, every single one of them assimilated, gone. But that was very, very strong. He fought battles. There were, in that movement, that was sort of between orthodoxy and unorthodoxy that we spoke about, like Gretz, was called Yiddish Wissenschaft, which meant Jewish science. It's what's called Jewish studies today. Hashem Shmuel Hirsch felt that they all are starting from the point of non-belief of Mesoris from Sinai, and therefore it's puzzle. And there was one particular person, I believe it was Chaya Frankel, whose works were considered to be okay, and he came out strongly against it. The big issue was, did the rabbis invent the halachas, or did they get, or was it a Mesoris halachas? And there were other rabbis who felt that he's unjustly maligning this other person. And he stood his ground. In the end, he said, all I need is him to make one statement. I accept everything he says, one statement. He believes that the Torah Shabbat as we have it was given me Sinai. Meaning, the basic halachas of how, what, when, and where. There are machlokas that came later, obviously. But still, he never would do that. And today, you know, obviously, it's today, it's in hindsight, it's much clearer. One more area that he would be extremely different. His last battle he fought, Reb Shlomo Zalman Hirsch, was a battle he did not win in his lifetime. And it hurt him terribly, and the community was very upset. And it was called Ostrit. I'll explain what that was. In the old days, church and government were very closely married. And even the Jewish community was sort of there was some government involvement. The government allowed you an autonomous community. They allowed you to tax the people in the community. They allowed you to maybe have a bezdin, maybe not. People, kings were not happy with having people run their own affairs. So everything had to go through the government. So the Jewish community of Germany was one community. You know, that was it. It was the Jewish community. If Shlomo Zalman Hirsch, you could not secede from the community. You could become a Christian or be a Jew part of the community. He was not allowed to be called a community. He was called Israelitische Religiöse Gesellschaft, which means Jewish religious society. That's all he was, a society. They had to pay taxes to the main community and double, you know, whatever they wanted for themselves. He had a law passed. He fought for it bitterly that Jews do not have to belong to the Jewish community. They can form their own Jewish community. You could have this community, this community, this community. And when the law passed, he got up in shul and he said, everyone has an obligation to separate themselves from the main community. People, only about a third of the community went along with him. And it hurt him. After he died, almost everybody went, you know, made their own community. Not clear why, but those also something that is remarkably different in the sense that just seeing the bigger picture, because he said, I accept everyone as a Jew and I love everyone, but I will not belong to a group that does not believe what I believe and feel that this is Judaism. He said, if it's going to be only dealing with secular things, you know, nursing homes, food for poor people, shelter, and so on, I'm willing to go along. But not if this is what religion is, because I'm making a statement denying the truth as I know it. So, we'll just wrap up and then we can talk a few minutes. So it's really a very complex picture. And let me tell you what I think is a takeaway from at least these two figures. Doing what everyone else does is not a positive value. Making a decision what one does. So for instance, let's give an example. If we make a decision that if everybody wears Hasidish clothing, you're not going to be able to find many jobs in society. It'll be very restrictive because people just snatch you, will not hire you, have anything to do with you, and it will create a lot of pressure. Therefore, we need to look more like everybody else, which I think was what my community, the literature community, did. That's a decision. You can make a decision that there's much of value, and we need to have Jewish doctors, Jewish lawyers, and so on and so forth. But one needs, in order to see a decision, one needs to be able to see what yes, what not. If the answer is automatically what they do, we do, then we are them. If someone else sets the standard for us, there are many reasons to pick and to choose different areas. So there were groups that felt the best thing is total insulation. Hungary worked like that. The advantage of that is you tend to preserve things. The disadvantage is the community is very restrictive. If a person has the ability to become an engineer, a doctor, or anything like that, there's no place for him to be that. If he comes in contact with nations around, he's severely handicapped. There are things that you can't incorporate that are good, structural things, administrative things, many things that society has developed that is good. You lose the ability to incorporate that. So the advantage is you preserve very strongly with a lot of warmth and so on. On the other hand, you're handicapped. And as you move along the continuum to being more and more open to society, and you give people more opportunities, you allow for certain things that society has come up with that's positive to incorporate it. On the other hand, people lose the sense of why we're different, unique, and the strength to be able to say, you know, everybody can think differently, I think differently. One can sit down and say, this is better, this is better. In Germany, Schwarzenegger saved Germany. In Hungary, Sam Sofa, who was extremely restrictive in the way he went about things, arguably saved Hungary. If one is honest, one can just point at the positives and the problems of each group. But the one thing that's absolutely needed to identify as a group that's worth discussing, that has legitimacy, is that you don't do what everybody else does, but you ask yourself, is going to a ball game a good thing or a bad thing? Could be either, could be neither. But the question is, am I willing, yes, to do it or not to do it? That's the most important piece. And what's my standard? Where am I measuring it against? Because everybody thinks like this, is that, does it make it right or not? Am I willing to take a stand ideologically that's opposite in the world? That's the test. Are you a Torah Jew who is expressing Torah through modernity or through whatever way you want to express it? Or am I just a person who's stuck between two worlds with a foot in each world? And, you know, when you have a foot in two places and one keeps going for the other, it's at some point you have to make a very tough choice. That's just sort of a bit of an overview of things. Now I'll allow you to speak, ask questions, whatever, however you want to go about it.
Yeah.
Okay. Where are you from yourself, Mrs. Egib? Could you do yourself? I know your husband. I see your husband around, but
thank you so much.
Where did you grow up yourself?
In Baraka.
Okay.
Yeah. So also a community that is very much shifted.
Right.
Right. So I guess wondering when we talk about this in class, you know, tomorrow, Thursday, just if we had any specifics or people that we can really turn to today who would embody this more, I guess, modern Orthodox viewpoint, view of the world, who can take a stand, and still have the respect of others who are around them. I find the world is very splintered right now, and it's very hard for somebody to take a stand. So I don't know if there's somebody that we can turn to who is really going to be an example today.
So, I mean, I said Reb Aaron Lichtenstein's Horn of Rachel was somebody, but he's gone. So I would say the people who can respect, who have the respect as a Talmud Chacham, and you know, a person of stature, would probably be people in Yeshiva University, who today, you know, many quote-unquote modern Orthodox are putting them into centrists. Very hard, because like I said before, these labels are very hard. But that's a place where people have, you know, where a Soloveitchik's standard of what a Talmud Chacham is stayed. So at least there's some sort of, so there are people there. It's hard for me to pinpoint someone in a particular, but I think that's at least somewhere where one can go to. In Israel, you have another complication, because in Israel, there's Zionism, religious Zionism, but some religious Zionists, in many ways, might be Haredi-like. In other words, you have a strange triangle. Scissor, paper, rock. Which one cuts which? In Israel, the split is a lot more between religious Zionism and Haredi, which is a Zionistic at best. One split. Religious Zionists, some of them overlap with modern Orthodox, go to university, army, so on and so forth. Some of them are actually extremely, extremely self-insulated and have no regard for the culture around. So in certain ways, those are very Haredi-like, couldn't care less what the world thinks, couldn't care less what the world says, doesn't give much respect to anything in the world. So are those people, in which camp are they? So, you know, the problem is when we try to identify people and so on. So in Israel, you would have, I guess, in the religious Zionist camp, there are people that probably would fill that. But it's hard for me to identify exactly the who that might be. I don't know. You know, it's a towering figure. I assume Reb Aaron Lichtenstein might have been the last person that was a genuine. He has a Talmud, Yibarach Chaim Tovim, Rosenzweig in Yeshiva University. I'm not familiar with him. I just know that he's a brilliant man and he's big Talmud Chacham and a Talmud. I'm not sure if he expresses himself on these topics. Reb Aaron Lichtenstein expresses himself very, very much. Reb Aaron Lichtenstein was actually a living example of somebody. He was an extraordinary Talmud Chacham. He was an extraordinarily knowledgeable person, very open to things, but also very, very strong sense. There were things he didn't look at, things he didn't want to. In other words, it wasn't a laxity. There were things he didn't just accept things because they were there. He accepted things because he felt he had something valuable to say. And that's hard. You know, most people, it's more a relaxed sense of things rather than a critical sense of things. If people would read Reb Aaron Lichtenstein's, again, they're not easy reads. But he examines himself a lot. He doubts himself. He formulates his ideas in ways that are remarkable. I mean, it's very, very. I mean, the person was a huge person, and I just want to give an example of what it means to be something like that. On one Tisha B'Av, so people were sitting in his house and eating after Tisha B'Av. It's a long hot day, long fast. And somebody knows Reb Aaron Lichtenstein's not around, and he asked the Rebbetzin, where's Reb Aaron? And she said, you know, on Tisha B'Av, there are two things you can't do. You can't eat, and you can't learn Torah. Everybody runs for the thing he misses the most after Tisha B'Av. My husband is sitting and learning, and the first thing he's doing is learning now. And then he'll get hungry. So, you know, yes, that's a very different, that's not just somebody who's just kind of, you know, the word easy doesn't describe that. You know, so again, I would assume I know Rev Rosenzweig is a Talmud. I don't know if he articulates these things, if he's into. I have no idea. You know, and when we're talking about, there were shades of people. I had a Rebbe who just passed away a year ago. Now it's Rav Moshe Shapiro, Tzion of Racha. He was an extraordinary person, very deep, brilliant. To the outsider, he was typically Haredi, I guess, learned in all the yeshivas, and looked Haredi. He was a person who could express himself extraordinarily eloquently and took his ideas from many places, but you never had a sense that he's incorporating foreign ideas. In other words, his mindset was Torah, but his vocabulary and his ability to put things in that were remarkable. There was a great French philosopher that heard him, and he said this was somebody that had been very close to Sartre. His name was Benny Levy, a French philosopher, totally secular. He was Sartre's secretary, and he got close to Rabbi Shapiro, and he became Haredi. And he said, this man is brilliant beyond words. But he would not quote anything other than Torah. Privately, you could talk to him, and he was. He told me once. I once asked him something, and he said, "This is Leibniz's first argument, for there being another being, something like that." I was like, kind of, taken aback. He said offhandedly, he said, "Yeah, basically, you're going back to his first argument." But he would never. He didn't feel it was right to say it in Spanish. So he knew a lot, used it as he felt right. But as I said, it's much more complicated than just labeling, this or this. It's the world is it comes with many dimensions. Yes.
What is it about of Cook and thereof that made you want to discuss the Rambam and a person say?
First of all, because they're older, the Rambam certainly stands apart, and Rav Cook, his real fundamental self, in other words, the most underlying theme in his writings in Rav Cook was Israel and the redemption and Zionism. He also was universal, but if you really wanted to identify him, Zionist is really the word that was the core other, so to speak. Soloveitchik was more difficult. I heard it myself a few times. I listened to a lot of tapes. It was amazing, but hard to know where his heart was. He felt very comfortable in a yeshivish jargon and environment, and the people around him who became or stuck to being Haredi yeshivish swore by all that's holy and good that that's what he was, and everything else was just a way of expressing himself. It's hard to see that. I don't know. I find that his own grandchildren have extremely conflicting opinions about him. In terms, everyone has the opinion that he was a huge person, but was there a main part and just a part that was used as a tool? His grandson, Moshe Tversky, Hashem Yikom Domo, who was killed 3 years ago in a terrorist attack. Moshe Tversky, his grandson, was a malach. I mean, he was a neighbor of mine. He would have been the Gadol Hador if he wouldn't have been killed. I mean, his being a Talmud Chacham, his Anava, his Tzitkis, his Midos, the man was way beyond anyone I know of any peers that I could think of. He was killed, Al Kiddush Hashem. But he was very strong. He said, when my grandfather began losing his cognitive abilities, he had a decline for years. He said, learning, he always was able to speak in learning. He spoke in Yiddish and in learning. So that was the real person. Everything else was a tool, but that's not the real him. That's what he told me. And he was very sincere about it, very strong about it. Does that reflect him? Does that reflect him? I don't know. He was a man that had many sides to him, and probably all of them are true, but it was hard for me to pinpoint and say this was the person. I'd say that's why I went to these there earlier, and there's more that we can look at and see that. That's the reason why I picked them. Yes, say that.
And so we have, like, a few months ago, Eitan Gross wrote his article.
Right.
And what does it mean for the future? Like, where's the modern orthodoxy going in the future?
So let me tell you, I would include all of us, not even modern orthodoxy. Let me explain to you why. you can create a system that creates general social mores and activities. Shul, davening, lulav nesek, tzitz, and so on and so forth. You can't really create a system that inspires and invigorates. And every movement goes through that crisis. Chassidus started as a highly inspirational movement. It's morphed into also a big group of people with bureaucracy and institutions. You know, moving from that. So in modern Orthodoxy, it's critical, because being able to have that inspiration while you're outside is critical. You can't, a person can remain a shomer mitzvah if he's somewhat insulated, even if he's not on fire. You can't do that if you're in the outside world. You know, if you're floating with the tide and the tide is going to the right place, you'll float to the right place, whether it's the best thing or not. But if you have to go against the tide, unless you're swimming really hard, so that's why it's a big challenge. It's also a very big challenge to be able to explain the importance of a world and significance, and yet explain that this is more important. Like I told people, if somebody puts a gun to your head and says, say that Yeshu is the true God, you're supposed to say, shoot. If somebody puts a gun to your head and says, tell me that a triangle has 200 degrees, and you know, if you add up the angles, you tell them 250, whatever you want. You know, and it's a hard, it needs to be, that's a piece that needs to be emphasized. When we talk about incorporating the, you know, using modern, using what modern science has brought to us, what modern society positive has done, but understanding the difference between there's only one thing that's b'chol nafshecha, b'chol meidecha, b'chol levavcha, it's a hard lesson. It's a hard lesson because it demands, you know, there was something somebody wrote an article about paying tuition for you know, that high price of tuition. This was a very famous article sent around. And the person said he went to a financial advisor, and the person looked at what he does, and he says, you know, you're paying too much for religion. Your religion demands 50% of your budget, from tuition, plus eating kosher, plus Pesach vacation. That's over 50% of your budget. That's where your problem is. Well, but in the morning, I said, b'chol mo'idecha, religion demands 100%. The Rambam, in the place that the Rambam gets most excited, is in Shmoneh Prokim, which is the introduction to Pirkei Avos. The Rambam says there is a Mishnah, there's one Mishnah in Pirkei Avos that has a message so powerful that it is more important than anything else written. And the Mishnah is Chol Maasecha Yu L'Shem Shemayim. In other words, everything a person does, he needs to ask himself, yes or no. The same thing, like, it's not enough to say, well, I'm modern, I go to a ball game. Is it good to go? What am I gaining? What am I losing? I'm reading this, I'm doing this report, I'm taking literature, I'm taking science, I'm taking physics. Everything can have an answer either way, but I need to be honest and I need to ask the question, what do I gain and what do I lose from it? Is this something that has important significance? There's nothing wrong with taking time off, but I have to label it, time off. How much time off is right? That's a really, really difficult piece. Modern Orthodoxy is not easier. It's harder if that's what you're doing. If you're just sort of saying, okay, it's a relaxed Judaism, then it's going to unravel. If you're telling me it's a very, very tough Judaism, I need to be firm and I need to take some positions that are extremely uncomfortable today about family, about marriage, about children, about everything. That having children is positive. That marriage is a man and woman. Hashem created it. That's what the Torah says. It's not popular today, but neither was Avodah Zarah. And in hindsight, we say, well, you know, how can everybody believe? I don't know. But we need to be able to stand strong and firm and proud of who and what is right, and yet be able to use the tools that the world affords us. It's a tough one. It's to be a person of that stature is not easy. And that's what I'm saying. And that's why I think his point is made, that it is a very strong point in that way. Okay. So it's been a pleasure being with you. And it's not the first time I've spoken. I find the boys and the girls to be very thoughtful. I keep saying boys, but Shiva Bar says boys. When I speak to boys, girls. But I find the young people here really to be thoughtful and questions. And some of you I've got to know over the years from the neighborhood. Bimatzliach, you're all seniors, I assume? Or what?
Yes. Yeah.
So you have a big year ahead next
except
year?
Except for me.
What?
I'm in 10.
Okay. So, but Be'ez Hashem, you should have a wonderful year next year. It's an amazing year for most people. It's really, really a year of transformation, a formative year. And understand, it's like when you have a drill, you have a motor and you have bits. Torah is the motor. Which bit you're going to use for what? Modernity is a bit, Hasidus is a bit, Yeshiva is a bit. All of these are different bits that you put onto the motor. But you don't choose the motor is the motor, and that has to be running strong and powerful. Even if you need a very fine line, it's going to reflect itself in the bit, but the motor is strong and powerful. Yiddishkeit has to be strong, powerful, and ready to make a decision no matter how difficult it is. Then you also need to make decisions, and there are many decisions, different people, different circumstances, different times. That's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu made many tribes, many different ways of expressing it, each person based on what he's good at and what the times and the place needs. Okay, a fellow Hanukkah.
And nice to send to me.
Yeah. Did you get the first part of it?
Okay. I got